I have a rule which I state loudly on every possible occasion. The rule is that I never write anything unless I am asked to do so. That sounds awfully haughty and austere, but it's a fake. As a matter of fact, I take it for granted that the various science fiction magazines and certain of my book publishers have standing requests for material, so I write for them freely. It's just the scattering of others that have to ask. In 1964, I was finally asked by Playboy to write a story for them. They sent me a dim photograph of a clay head without ears and with the other features labeled in block letters and asked me to write a story based on that photo. Two other writers were also asked to write a story based on that same photo, and all three stories were to be published together. It was an interesting challenge, and I was tempted. I wrote, "Eyes do more than see." In case I have given the impression in the previous introductions in this volume that my writing career has been one long succession of triumphs ever since Nightfall, that with me, to write is to sell, that I wouldn't recognize a rejection slip if some fellow writer showed me one, rest easy, it is not so. "Eyes Do More Than See" was rejected with muscular vigor. The manuscript came flying through my window all the way from Chicago, bounced off the wall, and lay there quivering. At least that's how it seemed. The other two stories were accepted by Playboy, and a third story by someone hastily called in to backstop me was also accepted. Fortunately, I am a professional of enviable imperturbability, and these things do not bother me. I doubt whether anyone could have guessed that I was disturbed, except for the short screaming fit of rage I indulged myself with. I checked with Playboy and made sure the story was mine to do with as I pleased, despite the fact it was based on their photo. It was. My next step was to send the story to F and SF, explaining to them, as is my wont in such cases, that it was a reject and giving them the exact circumstances. They took it anyway. Fortunately, F and SF works reasonably quickly, and Playboy works abominably slowly. Consequently, "Eyes Do More Than See" appeared in F and SF a year and a half before the story triad appeared in Playboy. I spent an appreciable length of time hoping Playboy would get indignant letters complaining that the situations in the triad had been stolen from an Asimov story. I was even tempted to write such a letter myself under a false name, but I didn't. I contented myself instead with the thought that by the time Playboy had published its triad, my little story had not only been published elsewhere, but had been reprinted twice and was slated to appear in still a third anthology. And this collection represents a fourth, and how do you like that, Mr. Hefner? First appearance, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, April 1965, copyright 1965, by Mercury Press, Incorporated. "Eyes Do More Than See." After hundreds of billions of years, he suddenly thought of himself as Ames. Not the wavelength combination which, through all the universe, was now the equivalent of Ames, but the sound itself. A faint memory came back of the sound waves he no longer heard and no longer could hear. The new project was sharpening his memory for so many more of the old, old, eons old things. He flattened the energy vortex that made up the total of his individuality, and its lines of force stretched beyond the stars. Brock's answering signal came. Surely Ames thought he could tell Brock. Surely he could tell somebody. Brock's shifting energy pattern communed. "Aren't you coming, Ames?" "Of course." "Will you take part in the contest?" "Yes." Ames's lines of force pulsed erratically. "Most certainly, I have thought of a whole new art form, something really unusual." "What a waste of effort. How can you think a new variation can be thought of after 200 billion years? There can be nothing new." For a moment, Brock shifted out of phase and out of communion, so that Ames had to hurry to adjust his lines of force. He caught the drift of other thoughts as he did so. The view of the powdered galaxies against the velvet of nothingness, and the lines of force pulsing in endless multitudes of energy life lying between the galaxies. Ames said, "Please absorb my thoughts, Brock. Don't close out. I've thought of manipulating matter. Imagine a symphony of matter. Why bother with energy? Of course there's nothing new in energy. How can there be? Doesn't that show we must deal with matter?" "Matter? Ames interpreted Brock's energy vibrations as those of disgust. He said, "Why not? We were once matter ourselves back a trillion years ago, anyway. Why not build up objects in a matter medium or abstract forms or... Listen, Brock, why not build up an imitation of ourselves in matter, ourselves as we used to be?" Brock said, "I don't remember how that was. No one does." "I do," said Ames with energy. "I've been thinking of nothing else, and I am beginning to remember. Brock, let me show you. Tell me if I'm right. Tell me." "No, this is silly. It's repulsive." "Let me try, Brock. We've been friends. We've pulsed energy together from the beginning, from the moment we became what we are. Brock, please." Then quickly. Ames had not felt such a tremor along his own lines of force in, well, in how long? If he tried it now for Brock and it worked, he could dare manipulate matter before the assembled energy beings who had so drearily waited over the eons for something new. The matter was thin out there between the galaxies, but Ames gathered it, scraping it together over the cubic light years, choosing the atoms, achieving a clayey consistency, and forcing matter into an ovoid form that spread out below. "Don't you remember, Brock?" he asked softly. "Wasn't it something like this?" Brock's vortex trembled in phase. "Don't make me remember. I don't remember." "That was the head. They called it the head. I remember it so clearly. I want to say it. I mean with sound." He waited, then said, "Look, do you remember that?" On the upper front of the ovoid appeared H-E-A-D. "What is that?" asked Brock. "That's the word for head. The symbols that meant the word in sound. Tell me you remember, Brock." "There was something," said Brock hesitantly. "Something in the middle, a vertical bulge formed." Ames said, "Yes, nose, that's it, and N-O-S-E appeared upon it. And those are eyes on either side, L-E-F-T-E-Y-E, R-I-G-H-T-E-Y-E. Ames regarded what he had formed, his lines of force pulsing slowly. Was he sure he liked this?
"Mouth," he said in small quiverings, "and chin, and Adam's apple, and the collarbones. How the words come back to me."
They appeared on the form, Brock said. "I haven't thought of them for hundreds of billions of years. Why have you reminded me? Why?" Ames was momentarily lost in his thoughts. "Something else. Organs to hear with. Something for the sound waves. Ears. Where do they go? I don't remember where to put them." Brock cried out, "Leave it alone! Ears and all else. Don't remember," Ames said uncertainly. "What is wrong with remembering?" "Because the outside wasn't rough and cold like that, but smooth and warm. Because the eyes were tender and alive, and the lips of the mouth trembled and were soft on mine." Brock's lines of force beat and wavered, beat and wavered. Ames said, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You're reminding me that once I was a woman, a new love, that eyes do more than see, and I have none to do it for me." With violence, she added matter to the rough-hewn head and said, "Then let them do it," and turned and fled. And Ames saw and remembered, too, that once he had been a man. The force of his vortex split the head in two, and he fled back across the galaxies on the energy track of Brock, back to the endless doom of life. And the eyes of the shattered head of matter still glistened with the moisture that Brock had placed there to represent tears. The head of matter did that which the energy beings could do no longer, and it wept for all humanity, and for the fragile beauty of the bodies they had once given up a trillion years ago.